From New York City, this is Film Spotting Streaming Video Unit. I'm Matt Singer.
And I'm Allison Wilmore. And to get us in the mood for this episode, in which we're going to talk about the 1934 classic, The Thin Man, Matt and I and all of our respective loved ones have treated ourselves to a stay in a couple of impossibly sprawling hotel suites in Manhattan, where we're just lounging around, sipping highballs.
This is just cruel.
This is a podcast. If you just play along, no one can actually see that we're huddled next to the crib in one of your children's bedrooms. Can't you just hear the clink of the glasses and the witty repartee of the glamorous guests in the room?
I absolutely cannot. Do I hear it? Oh, no, that's one of the children screaming. Forever. In honor of The Thin Man, we're going to be recommending some other movies about a topic near and dear to our hearts. Drinking! And all of the movies will be available to rent or stream right now. But before that, pour yourself a line of martinis, at least five or six, and get ready to solve a mystery or two, because we're going to talk about The Thin Man.
Pretty girl.
Yeah, she's a very nice type.
You got types?
Only you, darling. Lanky brunettes with wicked jaws. Leo, compliments to see you.
Who is she?
Oh, darling, I was hoping I wouldn't have to answer that.
Come on.
Well, Dorothy is really my daughter. You see, it was spring in Venice. And I was so young, I didn't know what I was doing. We're all like that on my father's side.
By the way, how is your father's side?
Oh, it's much better, thanks. And yours?
Say, how many drinks have you had?
This will make six martinis.
All right. Will you bring me five more martinis? Leo, line them right up here.
Yes.
Film Spotting Streaming Video Unit is, if the name didn't clue you in, a podcast about movies and television series that are available to stream. It's also a podcast in which we let you tell us what we should review. At the end of each episode, we give you three different films or sometimes TV series and let you vote on which one you'd like to hear us talk about. In honor of Warner Archives kind of merging with Filmstruck and a partnership with TCM, Turner Classic Movies, which is bringing a whole bunch of Hollywood classics to a streaming service that you probably already know has a lot of art and foreign films and Criterion titles, we decided to do three picks from the first round of TCM Select titles on Filmstruck. They were not what you would call lesser known fare. There's like Casablanca. So for our three options, we tried to pick some, like a mix, and at least one that we hadn't seen. Of course, you did not vote for that one. We went with
Jacques. We made it very clear which one we wanted, and the listeners gave us a resounding no thanks.
Yes, they're like, we don't really care.
We don't care. No, they really don't. We came in last place.
So the three options were Jacques Tourneur's 1943 horror film Cat People, the 1942 Betty Davis drama Now Voyager, and the 1934 detective film The Thin Man. And as Matt mentioned, despite our expressed preferences for Now Voyager, got totally creamed in the poll, coming in third, while The Thin Man took the lead and kept it. The Thin Man is based on a novel of the same name by Dashiell Hammett, who's best known for this hard-boiled detective fiction. The Thin Man, which would go on to spawn a six-film series and a television show, is far from hard-boiled. I'd say it is at best lightly and elegantly poached. The film that was adapted from it in 1934 was directed by W.S. Van Dyke and starred William Powell and Myrna Loy as Nick and Nora Charles. And it is fizzily unconcerned with getting serious, even when dead bodies start showing up. The Thin Man of the title is a kind of testy inventor named Clyde Winant, played by Edward Ellis, which is who the movie starts with. His disappearance, as noticed by his daughter Dorothy, played by Maureen O'Sullivan, is the mystery that propels the film forward. Though once Nick and Nora make an appearance, maybe about 11 minutes in, the movie becomes mostly an excuse to spend time in their very pleasant company. Nick is a retired detective who gets kind of reluctantly pulled slash goaded back onto the job by his wife. His wife, Nora, is a socialite and heiress, and the two seem to mostly spend their time hanging out with their very cute dog, Asta, and drinking heavily and enthusiastically. The first sequence of the two of them together finds Nora ordering six martinis together, lined up, in order to catch up to her husband, who's gotten a head start on her at the bar. So Matt, watching this movie for the first time in quite a while, it had been ages, I realized that aside from a particular detail involving the suit that's like a clue, I barely remember the actual mystery in The Thin Man at all. Though all of the scenes of the Charles's marriage I remembered very well. So did you have anything like that same experience? What do you think of the actual and fairly convoluted mystery that that the film is theoretically about?
Oh, it's incredibly convoluted. I don't know if there's ever been a better movie, a mystery movie, that where the mystery was less interesting or that you ended up caring less about it. Like, who cares? Who cares who did it? It almost doesn't even matter. It's just the excuse to get to hang out with Nick and Nora, who are totally delightful. No, I didn't remember anything about the mystery. And I'll tell you what, I watched the movie, what, 3 days ago? I don't remember anything about it now. If you quiz me on it, I mean, I know there was who got killed. I know who the Thin Man is. It's right. Not Nick Charles, which is a common misconception for people who haven't seen it. You know, he's not the title character, even though all the movies that followed had that in the title.
Right.
Sort of a very strange quirk of this series is that it's named after a victim instead of the hero. And so they made a bunch of movies and they kept calling them Thin Man movies, even though he wasn't in them.
It's which kind of a Frankenstein's monster type situation.
Yes, yeah, exactly. Situation. Exactly. So, yeah, the mystery is totally convoluted. It almost doesn't matter who did it. Or why. I mean, the end of the movie, I don't remember the exact lines, but, you know, at the end, there's this very, you know, the very famous, very cliched scene of everyone who could have possibly done it is gathered around a large table. They're all having a very cordial meal where...
It's a very glamorous dinner party.
An incredibly glamorous dinner party to involve, you know, like, accusations of murder. But I think even Nick says at one point, like Nora says to him, like, what are you talking about? Do you know what you're saying? And he's like, nah, I'm just making this up as I go. And that's sort of the fun of it. I think that's almost the pleasure of the movie, is that it invites you to not care, or it invites you not to get too invested in that, and it tells you this is a movie, this is a lark, this is a chance to enjoy the company of these very erudite, very witty, very charming characters and their adorable dog. And it, I don't know, I think that if we were to care for the mystery, it almost would be a weaker movie, because why waste our mental energy and divert our attention away from this one of the all-time great movie couples? Like, just enjoy their company.
Yeah. I mean, I will say there are some of the classics of film noir have extremely convoluted stories that you also don't care about. At
yes.
The end.
I mean, Dashiell Hammett was kind of an expert in the art of the convoluted mystery.
And Raymond Chandler as well. Yep. Right? There was the famous The Big Sleep. I don't know if it's just anecdotal, but where he's asked, who killed the chauffeur in The Big Sleep? And he was kind of like, I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, and The Maltese Falcon is famously like,
right.
Nobody knows.
Just twists itself in circles, yes.
Yeah.
Which I really enjoy. I enjoy like letting go of the kind of thing that's theoretically driving the narrative and to kind of let it all unfold. And I really enjoy that here. One thing I will say about the mystery and the kind of the Winant family, as we see it, and all of their kind of very sketchy hangers-on.
Yes.
They have quite a few.
Yes.
Including Cesar Romero as a kind of Lothario who has maybe married, the ex-wife.
Right.
Charles Winant's ex-wife.
Right.
It was such a kind of nice counterpoint to this very idyllic marriage that the rest of the movie is about, right? Like, you have this couple that just seems to have, they seem to understand each other, be on each other's wavelength so perfectly. And they have these two actors who have some of the greatest chemistry, I think, that gets captured on screen. And then they're going into this whole story about someone who is like cheated on his like very kind of grasping ex-wife, and then his mistress is also, you know, like, it's just all of these people just see like are all out to get each other.
Yeah, it's total sleaze and very tawdry,
and that it just mostly seems there to kind of like contrast with the relationship of our main characters, which is quite delightful.
That's a really good point. I hadn't thought about that, but you're absolutely right. There we have this very lovely example of a functioning relationship. and it's counterbalanced by everyone else in the movie who is a total mess.
Yes.
And it really does. I mean, the thing that I always think about when I watch it is just how it puts a lie to the idea that, oh, you can't have a good movie about a happy couple or a happy marriage, that there has to be drama or tension or any. There's no tension in this marriage. Like, the most tension is another thing that I love about it, which is that, like, Nick doesn't really want to be a detective, but it's Nora who keeps goading him into, like, getting in trouble and solving the mystery and having a lot of adventure.
Right. She wants to see it.
Yeah. Whereas, the stereotypical thing, even to this day, is, like, the scolding, nagging wife who wants the husband to settle down and, like, that's not what she's about at all. She wants the opposite. She wants to have fun. She wants to have adventure. She's upset that he stopped being a detective to be rich with her. And I just think that is so refreshing that she gets to have fun. And she wants to have fun. And she's sort of like goading him into basically being an alcoholic detective. And I think that is absolutely marvelous.
There's that one scene in which there's an intruder in the house and she gets like knocked out in the scuffle, and then she gets very angry and she's like, I wanted to see you. I knew you could take him.
Yes.
Why did you knock me out?
I mean, I guess it's very sort of very early post code or during code. It's not really quite pre-code.
I think it is pre-code.
Is it? Well, I mean, it's you know, it's not very salacious, but there, to me, like, that scene has this strong like intimation of like, This was hot. This was like a turn on for me to watch you beat up this guy. Why did you knock me out?
I mean, that is an undercurrent. That's like, you know, the idea that they have a great sex life is kind of this undercurrent throughout, even when they're sleeping in separate beds.
Which is another hilarious aspect of these.
I mean, like
movie.
The ending sequence in the train is like as close as it comes to, you know, like acknowledging a sex life. And I don't know. I mean, like, that seems to be as much a part of this, right? Mm-hmm. That they are – it's not just that they're happy, that there's something, like, electric between them.
Yeah. They have chemistry.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's, like, the classic thing of whether it was pre-code or not, you couldn't really show anything. And so it becomes this sort of, like, the feisty dialogue. It's like they're not allowed to have physical chemistry, so they get to have verbal chemistry. And like you said already, I think that there's – very few actors in history that have had better verbal chemistry. But it's not just verbal. I mean, they do have like these flirtatious things, like where he points at something on her that she's got like a spot on her dress, and then he pokes her nose, and then she like elbows him in the ribs. And it's just like, how often do you see couples that are just like into each other like this in a movie?
Yeah.
It's still, you know, 70 years later, it's so rare. It's just like, I don't know. The other thing about the movie is it just seems so easy. It just seems – they make it seem effortless. I mean, that's part of why we love Nick and Nora, is that Nick literally expends no effort. Like, being a detective, solving this incredibly convoluted mystery that literally if you asked someone after it's over to explain it, you couldn't. He can solve it while he's had 8 martinis.
Sure. But and I mean, like, his biggest venture, right? Like, the most effort he puts into this is going to look in the in Wynant's lab. Or
and then the dog
is.
Figures it out.
And the dog figures it out.
Right, exactly. The dog solves it, which is another absolutely wonderful thing about this is Asta and just the role he plays in the film. But just this idea that it's so – like the movie's vibe matches that character. It has this effortless, easygoing charm. And yeah, it's just – I don't know. I was reading about it after I watched it. It's like they shot it in 2 weeks.
Yes, which is a lot of like first takes.
Mind-boggling that you could get this much – I don't know that a movie could feel this just like sort of effortless and have that perfect sort of energy and charisma on the, as you're saying, like first takes and it shot in 2 weeks. It's really pretty miraculous. It's not like one of my favorite movies ever, but just the like achievement of it is so impressive.
Yeah. And I think that one of the things I appreciated, especially watching it this time, what were the ways in which the movie just kind of emphasizes the trust between the two of them. Mm-hmm. Not just that she trusts her husband to be able to pull these things off, you know, like, but also even like this scene in which she kind of bursts in on him comforting Dorothy and isn't like, what's going on here?
Yes.
There's never any doubt between the two of them that like anything would. Yeah. And I think that there is something about that, like, it's just so refreshing because it's such an expected beat to be like.
That's another stock. Any movie about a married couple, there has to be, again, it's got to be drama and tension. The wife has to think the husband is cheating. And like you said, that scene happens and she's just like, whatever, you know. I mean, she is Nora Charles. Like, who's going to cheat on Nora Charles?
Yeah, yeah.
Let's be fair.
As she, you know, she says as much herself.
Yeah,
she's like, I'm a real catch.
She is. She is a real catch.
It was... I think, like, it is interesting to think about this movie coming out, like, probably, like, the height of the Depression. I mean, Prohibition had just been repealed. And I think in the book, in the novel, they're making do with, like, illicit liquor. And here they can drink freely. But, like, to think about the context of that in both ways, like, both the boozing just feels like, you know, like the Prohibition had just been lifted, that they're just, like, jumping so fully back on board. But also, I think there are so many ways in which the, like, just effervescent lightness of this and the kind of, like, easy luxury these characters live in, like, blissful luxury. Like, when you think about watching that in the context of the Depression, like, it also makes so much sense. Just, like, it is this purest kind of escapism, in that it is this fantasy of just having this, like, idle, rich life.
Right.
Right? And just, like, living for pleasure.
Right. It is one of the fascinating aspects of this movie and a lot of screwball comedies of this era is that if you – I mean, there are absolutely movies about the Depression and about the hard times, but you could make a pretty extensive filmography and a very respectable – the great, you know, great films of the period – where the Depression does not exist, you know, like that you could just watch, especially if you're watching the comedies, like they're all about these fabulously wealthy people who are not just rich. They never work. They don't have to work. It's just like the thing that so many people were worried about daily is just like the next, you know, the next week's paycheck or surviving day to day. It's just like it's not even a consideration. I mean, here they've inherited money. Like Nick Charles was a detective. He quit his job to be rich, essentially. Right. He quit his job because he did not need to work anymore because the Nora's somebody died and left them a ton of money and property. And, yes, like, he takes care of it.
Right.
He
is, like, managing their estate.
Right.
Yes.
But we never see him actually do any work in the movie that involves that at all. Now, granted, they're sort of on vacation here, I guess.
I mean, there's a part. I feel like he makes some mention of, like, they've gone to New York to, like, get away from all the partying in San Francisco, which is seems like a very ineffective trick in this case.
Yes.
Like, not really working out.
No. Can we talk a little bit about Asta?
Asta is a spectacular dog.
I would argue that Asta is the greatest character in the history of cinema.
That's it's a bold statement.
Who's better than Asta?
I mean, I can't argue.
Come up with a better character.
You know, you're right.
I love the way Asta is introduced, like, pulling at the leash. Just like, how do you explain who this dog is? It's just like the anti-Nick in a way. Like, Nick is the one who's just, like, soused and wandering and just late. And Ass is, like, the one making the beeline, which comes back again later. Very consistent characterization of this dog. That he comes when they're searching, and as you said, they're searching in the office or the lab or whatever, and Asta is the one who makes the discoveries. Like, he's the one who has purpose and drive, unlike his owner,
right,
which
and
I
they're
love
just kind
too.
Of like weaving around unsteadily on their feet,
yes,
and into the a solution for the mystery.
Which is good, because let's face it, if they had a dog that was needy, that dog would be dead 100 times over, because they couldn't care for a dog.
Yes, they absolutely could not. No. I do like the part where Nick kind of threatens someone with Asta, who is, like, hiding under a table.
Yes, yeah, the same scene with the
tear
intruder.
Yes,
yeah.
And Asta, not going to do that. But,
yeah, I mean, he's clearly the smartest character in the film as well.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
What is your favorite scene in this movie? Because I particularly love the scene, that not related to mystery solving at all, in which on Christmas Day, Nick is shooting
with the air
balloons.
Rifle.
Yes, with the air rifle. It is just like a perfect sequence.
That's a very good scene. I love the ending because it is so willfully like, it's like a middle finger to anyone who's trying to think that they have the mystery solved, or even that the mystery mattered. I mean, where Nick is like openly acknowledging that not only does he not know who did it as he's solving it, quote unquote, but that it's just like he's making it up as he goes, and then he gets it right anyway. I just think that I don't know. I just love the idea of like that times gathering everyone together into a very posh dinner party to expose a killer. I think it's just that's always the right way to solve a crime. Wearing
Absolutely.
A tuxedo, sitting around a dining table with like 20 people who are all disgusting. It's wonderful.
Yeah. What I really enjoy about that sequence, beyond Nora's evening gown, which is a beautiful
She has some
gown.
Several very beautiful dresses
she has,
in this
Yeah, she has
movie.
Amazing outfits, is just how like hilariously cruel serious news is broken to Dorothy. It's like, I'm like, this is a really, considering she's supposedly an old family friend, a really like terrible thing to do.
In their defense, though, they're very drunk.
They're extremely
drunk. They're
drunk
all the time.
Yeah, we didn't even talk about, I mean, like, Nick is introduced instructing bartenders as to the correct way to shake a cocktail.
Teaching the bartenders.
Yes. But also, I mean, frankly, drinking six martinis, I would be slurring and a disaster.
I mean, I would be dead.
Yeah.
Let's be real.
But and also, I like that in their morning after a hangover routine, Nora has, I guess, an ice pack that she ties to her head.
Yes.
Just like... very fetching.
And I think you also get the sense she's used to this. This
yes.
not the first time she's done this. You know, like this is the, like you said, it's a routine. This yep. is the hangover routine. No, they're just very much aspirational figures to be.
Yes.
I mean, you mentioned the depression aspect, and I think at that point they were even more aspirational and more fantastical and more desirable. But now 70 years later, I mean, it's just like they're rich. They love each other. They've got great chemistry. They got an awesome dog. They drink all the time and they solve mysteries.
And they just flutter back and forth
yeah,
around
and
the country.
They have a great time. Like, yes. what is not to enjoy about this? And what is not to aspire to?
Yeah. No, it's a pretty dreamy movie. And yeah. I think in that way, you know, we spoke a little bit about the leads. But, like, I think in that way that also just, like, appreciates its main it's main actors so much and the, how they are on screen together.
Yeah. The only thing I would say is that the one knock I always feel is like that whenever they're not on screen, the movie is just like takes a nosedive. And it right. starts with like 10, 12
it
minutes
starts,
without
yeah.
them at all. Like
right.
it starts with Winant and it starts with this conspiracy about the secret and the whatever he's hiding. It's like, who cares?
Yeah.
Especially once they appear, you're like, why did we spend all that time with other people?
It's a very roundabout way to come around to, especially as this movie, if you will forgive me for saying this about a film classic, served essentially as a kind of pilot for, you know, like
right.
they went on to birth this whole stream of lucrative sequels.
The Thin Man cinematic universe.
Exactly. That it's striking that the movie does not start with its main characters, but starts by just kind of like taking this very sideways route into a story that, as we've discussed, really doesn't matter all that much.
No, I mean, it's sort of one of the interesting things about it. Again, it's not called Nick and Nora. It's called The Thin Man, and it starts with The Thin Man. It's almost like it doesn't realize, as they're making it, it almost like feels like, and I know it's based on a book, but it almost feels like they discovered that was what the movie was about while they were making it, like in the process of it, but it was yeah. too late to go back and shoot a different introduction because they only had 2 weeks to make the whole movie.
Right, and Dashiell-Hammett only wrote one novel about this. All of the sequels were from, you know,
just inspired by.
Just inspired by.
I know, that is sort of surprising given, as you said, how many things. There's a radio show and a TV show and 6 movies and a musical, I think, on Broadway. Yeah, that it was just one book. And it does seem like it would lend itself to, you know.
Sure.
It makes sense as a TV show to me because who cares what the mystery is? It's just about you just love those characters.
Yeah, and love the idea of accidentally almost solving mysteries, even though they get in the way of your drinking,
yes.
as Nick says. Really put you behind on your drinking.
That's right.
Well, all right. That is The Thin Man. You don't need us to tell you The Thin Man is great, but it is great. And it is streaming on Filmstruck.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
All right, let's do some cue shots. Let's recommend some other movies about drinking. And before we do that, we just want to set the ground rules here very quickly. But even before we do that, Allison, I have a question that
yeah.
I'm just curious about. What is your favorite drink?
Oh, I mean, this is going to make me sound like I'm an aspiring film noir person.
That's
but
okay.
I drink rye on the rocks.
Mm.
Usually, my basic go-to is bullet rye on the rocks.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't really like any cocktails that are mm-hmm. too sweet usually.
Not even a whiskey cocktail, a Manhattan, an old fashioned.
I don't mind an old fashioned,
yeah.
but I mean these days it just feels like why get in the
why waste? Yeah, why are we
all
wasting
precious
the time?
Alcohol?
Yes, that's fair.
Yeah, how about you, Matt? What is
I mean,
your
drink? We're this. No wonder we've done this for so many years. We just get along. I mean, that's the same. I don't need to be rye. I'm not
yeah.
even that picky. Is it brown? Is it whiskey?
It's a whiskey drink.
Yeah, I
on
mean,
the rocks or neat.
It depends on the alcohol. If it's really good alcohol, I'll have it neat. If
yeah.
if I'm cheap, then I'll have it on the rocks.
Fair enough.
I think Nick Charles would approve of that
yeah,
approach.
I think so.
How much am I spending and how much do I have to disguise it? No, I you know, whiskey, scotch, bourbon.
Yeah.
Doesn't matter.
Yeah. I like all of those, too.
I just, you know, when I drink the bottle, I go buy a new bottle. And I don't ever buy the same one twice. I just like trying lots of different kinds.
Yeah. Though that's a good approach. Yeah. I have like a few go-tos, but I'm not loyal to any particular brand. But yeah. I did go from being a real bourbon person to being a bit more of a rye person.
I can't argue with
this
that.
Is that. As we slowly medicate ourselves with right. alcohol in order to get by.
Slowly?
Well, you know, gradually, how about that? Been building over the years.
Okay, so on that note, now that we've exposed our drinking bona fides,
yes.
we wanted to make it clear that this is not going to be a podcast about alcoholism.
Which could be its own episode.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And while you probably could argue, and God help us, if they ever remade Nick and Nora Charles, I can see the hot takes now. Nick and Nora Charles are alcoholics and they're a bad example for society, well, I mean, et cetera, et cetera.
Certainly, like, if you're knocking back 6 martinis a night, you're going above any recommended intake by yes. any medical professional. Certainly.
But I mean, the movie does not make it. There's no hint that that is the case. I mean, you could definitely right. look at their behavior and say this is the behavior of alcoholics, but there are no repercussions for them.
Yeah, other they're than doing fine. They look great.
They're doing better than fine.
Yes,
they're doing fabulous. So we didn't want to do a movie, a podcast about movies about alcoholism, because that's not what The Thin Man is about. So it's about drinking. We wanted to make that clear right off the bat.
Yes, even though I feel like there are certainly at least one of my picks, alcoholism is this kind of specter lurking in the background.
Mine too. Yeah. But no one ever comes out and says it.
Yes, we're keeping it light, is what we're saying. Ish.
Yes.
Yes. Yeah. I think yeah. we're doing. These are all. I think all of our films are comedies or comedy-ish.
Mine both are.
Yes. All right. There we go.
Do you want me to start? Or you
Why
want
don't
to...
you start?
All right. So I figured, because I did love The Thin Man, rewatching it, and I did love Nick and Nora particularly, and I wanted to spend some more time with them. And we didn't really talk about Filmstruck during our review, but we had less time on the show. That poll was a Filmstruck poll. It was all Filmstruck choices. Yep. So I thought, well, if people... you know, are actually, you know, going to sign up for Filmstruck, try it because of our podcast, let me at least throw in one more Filmstruck movie into here. And so that made my first pick very easy. I went with After the Thin Man from 1936. This is the first of the 5 Thin Man sequels. And based on a very informal Twitter poll I did, it is the one that most people think is the best, the most worth watching. I had never seen any of the sequels.
I have seen none of the sequels.
I had seen the original before, but never seen any of the sequels. And so I figured I'm going to watch one. And I liked it. It is not as good as the first movie overall, but it's Nick and Nora. It's William Powell. It's Myrna Loy. They are still delightful together. And I enjoyed the film as a whole. It is set immediately after the first film. The first film ends with this train ride that we discussed in the review. The second movie begins with the end of that train ride. They're returning home to San Francisco just in time for New Year's Eve. And they go to visit Nora's family. And they discover that her cousin's husband has gone missing. And then Nick and Nora find him, tell him to go home. But then on the way home, he is murdered. And Nora's cousin becomes the prime suspect. And so it is up to Nick and Nora to find the real killer. And as we discussed in the main review, Thin Man, the first Thin Man, was shot in 2 weeks and is a very small film when you think about it. It's mostly on sets and just a handful of sets, really. And it makes the most of what it has, and it really gets by in the script and in the personality department, the raw chemistry of those characters. And After the Thin Man is definitely a bigger production. You could tell that they knew they had a hit on their hands and they were going to put a little bit more money behind it. It has more locations. It has more outdoor stuff. There's some very nice, foggy, noirish nighttime scenes involving the murder and stuff like that. It even has a musical number. And I enjoyed that about it. You know, Nick and Nora, there are these very elegant, wealthy socialites. They deserve a movie that matches their expansive lifestyle. The Thin Man, as lovely as it is, I don't know that it necessarily fully matches that. It does feel a little cheap in a way. I mean,
but their hotel room is.
Their hotel room is great.
Wonderfully sized.
But you wouldn't look at that movie and say, wow, they spent a lot of money on this movie. If you know movies at all, you say this movie is like a B movie. It's definitely made relatively on the cheap. And After the Thin Man definitely feels like they ratcheted it up to match the character's expensive tastes. And I like that about it. And the supporting cast of the film includes a very young Jimmy Stewart. He's basically like the third or fourth lead in the film. He plays the unrequited love of the cousin. And it's kind of awesome to see a very young Jimmy Stewart. Oh, Nick and Nora, it's great to see you. Yeah, welcome back. Heard you had a lot of fun in New York City and all that. It's really cool to see him just randomly in this movie. In terms of what I didn't like quite as much as the first film, not enough Asta. We established he's like the best character.
Disastrous.
Well, he's in it. And there's this thing where his wife, Mrs. Asta?
What?
I don't know. There's like a Mrs. Asta, and it seems like she's been two-timing him with another dog. Mm. It's a whole thing, and that's fine, but I need more like crime-solving Asta. Like, to me, I wouldn't have minded if eventually they phased Nick and Nora out, and it just became Asta was like the main character.
Solving crimes. Perfect movie.
The crime-solving dog who's owned by the two degenerate drunks. I would have no problem if that was what it was. So that's a little bit of a step down. And certainly you have to accept the fact that this retired detective keeps getting into scrapes. Like, literally, this is like a week after he solved this mystery accidentally. He, a week later, has to solve another mystery accidentally. It's kind of like Die Hard, where it doesn't make any sense for this character to keep getting into these problems, but you love the character so much, you love the sort of enjoyment of watching him, that you just sort of accept it. So you have to kind of go along with that. But if you enjoyed The Thin Man, I would say it's definitely worth a watch. I can't speak for any of the other sequels. I haven't watched any of those yet, but it is great to see more Nick and Nora. They are great together. They have some very sharp, you know, repartee. The banter is still there. I did like the scene where at the very beginning of the movie, they're getting ready to get off the train, and Nora says, "Are you packing?" meaning their luggage, and he's pouring a drink, a very large drink, and he says, "Yes, I'm putting away the liquor." And I mean, that's a great line right there. So, yeah, this one is after The Thin Man, and I believe all of the Thin Man movies are now on Filmstruck. I'll double check to make sure, but they have a bunch of them. So while Allison's talking, I'll confirm that. But, yeah, if you want to have like a Nick and Nora marathon, Filmstruck is the way to go. So this is after The Thin Man.
Well, my first pick is also on Filmstruck, and it is the first film that came to mind when we said we would talk about movies about drinking. It is With Nail and I, Bruce Robinson's semi-autobiographical 1987 comedy about two unemployed actors sharing a really terrible flat in London in the 60s. And one of them is Withnail, played by Richard E. Grant. And the other one goes unnamed on screen, is credited as I, played by Paul McGann. And I thought of this movie in particular because there's a drinking game associated with it, in which all you do is try and keep up with what Withnail drinks over the course of the movie.
Oh, no.
Yes. So according to fansite withnaillinks.com, here is what he drinks. 9.5 glasses of red wine, 1 pint of cider, 1 shot of lighter fluid, 2.5 shots of gin, 6 glasses of sherry, 13 whiskeys, and 0.5 pint of ale. If you were to actually drink that, I think you would die, probably not even getting all the way through.
Yeah.
But also, Withnail does have the benefit, to his credit, of having a few days, the days
right.
over the,
he's not
the
doing
movie,
this in 90,
an hour and a half. Yes.
Minutes, yeah.
But also, he does a lot of drinking off screen, so he drinks a lot more than this. This is just what we see him drink. But Withnail is a prodigious drinker of alcohol and consumer of substances. The movie actually starts out with both of these characters having come down from, I think, a multiple-day speed binge, and they're both broke, they're on the dole, they're spending all of their money on alcohol and can't really afford to heat their flat, which never was also like a total disastrous mess. And neither of them seems to be getting calls from their agents or seems to be getting work. And the whole, like, the story of this movie, as much as there is one, is that they basically finagle use of this cottage to get away, to go to the countryside, to refresh themselves from Uncle Monty, who's played by Richard Griffiths, who is Withnail's wealthy uncle, and who, unbeknownst to I, has a thing for I, and Withnail has led his uncle on to believe that I is gay and would at least be, you know, welcome his advances in some way. And so a lot of the film, beyond just being about how they cannot handle being in a country cottage and have no idea how to handle the countryside, don't know how to heat the place, don't know how to find food. Cook at one point, they are given a live chicken and kill and cook it in a way that is extremely memorable. Mostly they drink. They drink an astonishing amount. They are very drunk all of the time, including driving on the way back, which does not go very well. And I think that there's really something to this movie about, like, what it is like to be at this point in your life when you are like a total mess, but also there's something exhilarating about being such a mess and having nothing. And this movie is very kind of like, there's a real sad undercurrent to this movie in that it's literally set like 3 months before the end of the 60s. And there's this real funereal air over everything. It's not romantic about the 60s, but at the same time, there's this real sense of this era, this decade ending, and kind of like everyone coming down from a high. And one of the kind of things that is matching that is the idea that this friendship between these two characters, as disastrous a friendship as it is, but it's like such a funny one, and it's one you're so deeply invested in, this friendship is going to come to an end, that one of them is going to find work, and one of them is going to grow up, and it's not Withnail. Withnail is not the one who is going to go off to a spectacular career. You know, Robinson based this movie on his own experiences. He shared a rundown Camden flat with an actor named Vivian McCarroll, who did not go on to bigger things, so he acted in a few roles. But and apparently Uncle Monty is based on Franco Zeffirelli, who apparently had a lot of kind of amorous aims that Robinson was really not that interested in returning. But I think that you can sense this in the movie as well. McCarroll died, I think, when he was about 50, because of the side effects of how much drinking he did. And that you can just kind of sense that Withnail is, who is like, you know, this fantastic character, is not going to go on to greater things. But it's Withnail that the movie ends with. And I think, you know, on the topic that we're talking about, I was spectacularly drunk at a party a few nights ago, and someone was asking, what the best movie endings were, and I could not come up with any because I was too sozzled. But I will say the ending of this movie is just about perfect, and in that way, where it's also tremendously sad, but like not at all at the same time, and I think that, you know, as a movie about things ending as well, it manages to be a really funny comedy and sometimes a kind of mean comedy, and then also a really tragic one at the same time. Don't try and drink as much as Withnail, please. We don't advise that here on Film Spotting SVU. We will not be responsible if you try that.
Don't tell me what to do, Mom.
All right. I would love to see you try and drink even just like 9.5 glasses of red wine in an hour and a half.
That wouldn't go well for anybody. I definitely couldn't do it.
Yeah, well, that is Withnail and I, and it is streaming on Filmstruck.
All right, a great choice. My second pick is a movie that I really loved when it came out. I have not seen it in probably at least a dozen years. It is Sideways from 2004, directed by Alexander Payne. It is the story of a pair of heavy drinking buddies, Miles, played by Paul Giamatti, and Jack, played by Thomas Hayden Church. They make a trip up to wine country to celebrate Jack's impending marriage. Miles got divorced 2 years ago and still hasn't gotten over it. He's working on a novel that it seems like he probably will never publish. And Jack is getting married, but he's clearly having second thoughts, or at least is not all that gung-ho about the idea. And he keeps pushing Miles to help him, or also to hook up with the women they meet in wine country, particularly this lovely waitress, Maya, that Miles has met on previous trips to the area, who's played by Virginia Madsen. And then the waitress's friend, Tara, who works in a winery, played by Sandra Oh. Now, I saw this movie I saw it when it came out. I might have seen it once or twice after that, but, you know, not in over a decade. I really liked it at the time. It's a funny movie, and it's fun to sort of travel with these characters, and you get this lovely sort of picturesque tour of wine country. It makes going to all these tastings seem kind of, I don't know, beautiful, exotic. The photography of the area is really nice. And the score by Ralph Kent is this very jaunty jazz score. And, I don't think as a guy in my early to mid-20s, I really appreciated just how sad and desperate the movie is.
Tremendously so.
And how much the drinking, speaking of the drinking, dovetails with that. Miles is, I guess, more of like an amateur expert, but a wine expert. And he's showing his friend Jack a good time, but also like teaching him how to drink wine the right way. But he's also a snob. And it's also very clear that he's drinking heavily. And again, they don't really call themselves alcoholics. No one calls them alcoholics in the movie. But I think, again, if anyone labeled them as such, you'd have a hard time arguing that that was the case. But that he's drinking, in particular, Miles is drinking, as a way to kind of drown the pain of this marriage ending badly. And so you have this very interesting contrast that I don't know that I even fully appreciated when it came out, as much as I enjoyed the film, between the comedy on the surface. And it is a very funny movie at times, and the sort of floundering that these men are doing in their lives below the surface. And it really goes hand in hand with Paul Giamatti's performance, which I thought was even better than I remembered it, the nuances of his work here, that he can simultaneously be so funny and amusing and kind of charming, but at the same time, he is such an obnoxious just jerk and so pompous and full of himself. And Paul Giamatti just threads such a beautiful line there. And I can't think of a lot of actors who could pull that off, where you simultaneously feel bad for the guy because of everything he's going through. At the same time, you just want to smack him right in the face because of what he's going through and what he does. And I mean, I totally had forgotten the scene where he goes to visit his mom for her birthday. And this is this guy, he steals money from his mother.
Yeah.
He tells her they're going to stick around for her birthday brunch the next day, and then sneaks out before she wakes up, so he doesn't even have to tell her he's not going to stay for it. And this is the hero of the film. And in terms of the drinking aspect, a little more about that. Again, the drinking and the touring of wine country is such a huge part of the film that even though the movie definitely has this sort of kind of sad, pathetic dimension to it, the movie was a huge apparent booster of tourism in the area for a period that, you know, people saw this movie and they wanted to go to wine country. And supposedly I was reading online that it not only boosted sales of Pinot Noir, which is the wine that Miles likes, it depressed sales of Merlot, which very famously he refuses to drink. Merlot is the wine he will not drink. And watching it this time, it did occur to me, which hadn't before, that Miles likes Pinot Noir because Pinot Noir is like Miles. He describes it at one point, the grapes at one point. He says they're very thin-skinned, they don't like heat or humidity, and they're very delicate. And it's clear to me now that he's talking as much about the wine as he is about himself, and that in some ways, in some bizarre, twisted way, he identifies with Pinot Noir, and that is why he likes it so much. And so I honestly wasn't sure if I would like this movie, revisiting it. I didn't know how I would think it would hold up because I wasn't sure. And I have to say, I was not a fan of Alexander Payne's last movie at all. But I have to say, I really liked it. I liked it even more than I expected to. And like I said, this whole dimension of just how sad the characters are, I don't know, maybe it's me being older that it really hit me even harder this time. Sideways, really liked rewatching this one. It is currently available on HBO Go or HBO Now.
That's a particularly good movie about how wine fandom can be used to mask what is like alcoholism.
Absolutely. 100%.
And just like, just because it's being done.
It is a socially acceptable way to just drink a ton.
Exactly.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, so my next pick is from a director who's really, I think, kind of become known for having a lot of scenes of characters drinking, getting drunk, like awkward. Like, he makes movies about men and women and these kind of sometimes awkward, funny, dark interactions between them, and alcohol is absolutely the fuel for his movies. It is Hong Sang-soo, and I'm going to talk about Right Now, Wrong Then, which is his 2015 film that's streaming on Fandor. He's a really prolific filmmaker who has these kind of recurring themes. He often has characters who are filmmakers. They are often not particularly admirable characters. He makes these movies about infidelity and kind of disappointments. And also he makes them about getting utterly trashed on soju, usually soju. And this movie is, it's like a lot of his movies, a kind of two-part movie. It's bifurcated. And in this case, it's it runs through the same basic story twice. In both halves of the movie, there is a successful art film director who's played by Jung Jae-young, who travels to Suwon for a screening and Q&A at a film festival that both times we see it is like very amusingly underpopulated. There are like five people there. He gets to town a day early and he's kind of bumbling around sightseeing. And he meets a woman played by Kim Min-hee, who you may also know from The Handmaiden. She's an aspiring painter. He's immediately smitten with her, even though he is married and clearly also is known for being a womanizer. They have coffee. They go to her studio to look at her work. They get drunk on soju. They go to a small gathering at her friend's cafe where they proceed to drink more. And the next day he goes to his screening. And so that happens twice with like little differences that kind of tilt one of these stories more into, I would say, like painful awkwardness. And then the second one into hilarious awkwardness. but neither one, I don't know that you could say either particularly is super successful as an encounter. But in both also, like the idea that drunkenness can free you up in some way from your social burdens is like a huge part of this, of the movie. And in the first storyline, the director flatters the woman. He looks at her painting and he tells her this, he kind of has this spiel that about like, you don't know where you're going, but you're finding your way. And she's very moved by it until they go drinking with her friends later. And the friend points out that that's just something he says in interviews all the time. In the second story, he confesses to being married. He still declares his love for her, but he is also like brutally frank about her painting. And somehow this all works out to be slightly more positive. But I think in terms of the drinking in particular, I will say this has some very funny scenes of drinking and of just like the ways in which it kind of peels off a layer of skin and makes people vulnerable in sometimes like really unsentimental, funny ways. The second bout of drinking in particular, in the second half of the movie, involves the main character or the director character who in the first half of the movie insists he's never gotten drunk in his life, that he can drink a lot. In the second half of the movie, he falls down on the floor with drinking with two strangers. He falls down on the floor and then he gets up, gets stuck in his sweater, removes his shirt, squeezes his belly fat, and then proceeds as the camera pans away to the horrified faces of these two women to disrobe further. And it's so funny. there's just this kind of like really dry, ruthless sensibility to a lot of Hong Sang-soo's approach to comedy in these films. He is just really kind of like brutal to these characters, especially the ones that are his relative stand-in. So I find with his films that I tend to like them, but I also tend to kind of blur into each other a lot because they cover so much similar story, kind of story elements. But I think that right now, Wrong Men is maybe my favorite of his because I think it does all of the things that he tries out in different films in the best way. It is about the ways in which if your two options are kind of shielding yourself through lies and flattery and self-puffery, or rendering yourself ridiculous through brutal honesty, then maybe the second is a little better than the first, but neither of them is like a guaranteed happy ending, even when you obliterate yourself on soju. So that is right now Wrong Men, and it is streaming on Fandor.
All right, we've got a hodgepodge of new movies to briefly talk about here before we get to Behind the Eight Ball. We have one film we've both seen and then a couple of movies that one of us has seen but not the other. We'll run through those very quickly. The film we've both seen and can discuss, I imagine, is going to be of some interest to our listeners because it is the new Wes Anderson film. It is Isle of Dogs, his first stop-motion animated film since Fantastic Mr. Fox. It is about this dystopian future where all the dogs in Japan have been shipped off to this trash island. It's literally called Trash Island. because they all have canine flu and they're worried it's going
to be snout fever
and they're afraid they're going to spread it to humans. And so all the animals have been banished. And so this one little boy goes to the island. He flies himself there looking for his long lost dog. That is the premise of the film. Allison, did you like Isle of Dogs?
I would say it's probably my second least favorite Wes Anderson movie.
What's your least favorite?
Darjeeling Limited.
Okay.
Yeah. I think a lot of its charms, and it definitely has charms, are familiar ones. This movie is in some ways like Moonrise Kingdom by way of Fantastic Mr. Fox.
Right.
I think still, whenever a dog cries in this, which happens a few times, it is moving, yes. Undeniably moving.
Yes.
And it does also, I think, like, it leans into a lot of Anderson's weaknesses, including the fact that he has never been great with regards to race. Mm-hmm. And this is a movie that kind of uses a fantasy Japan in this fairly, kind of like classically Orientalist way. Mm-hmm. And, not malicious, but it's certainly like not considered at all. There's no sense of awareness that you need to have that. It feels a bit like Anderson just kind of like not moving forward at all, but just kind of disappearing slowly inside one of his little miniature boxes.
Yeah. I would largely agree. I did enjoy parts of it. As you said, the dogs cry occasionally and it's like,
I'm
dead inside, but I'm not that dead inside. Yes. Like, good luck. Yeah. There's a very touching scene involving like a bath, a boy giving a dog a bath, which is just like, yeah. That's a great scene. And there's a couple of really charming scenes. And Jeff Goldblum plays a dog who always hears gossip. He's, have you guys heard the rumors about X, Y, or Z? Anything involving the movie that they're, who knows where he's getting these rumors from, that is amazing. And then there's also a little pug character, the Oracle. I won't spoil how the Oracle is so all-knowing, but that character, who has a very small part, is absolutely hysterical and charming and wonderful.
Yes.
But yeah, I did think a lot of the stuff set on Japan, in Japan, just felt very tone deaf to me.
Yeah.
And some of the decisions he made is just like, these are bad calls. These are very, very bad, strange, peculiar choices that he's making.
Including, he obviously married two different ideas, which was like this, the dog idea. Like he wanted to make a movie about dogs and he had this idea of like exiled dogs.
Yes.
With this urge to make a movie set in Japan.
Yes.
And the two don't really have a lot to do with one another.
No.
Yeah.
I mean, I think to me the issue is like he has the dogs all speaking in English and all the Japanese characters speak in Japanese. And there is absolutely a reason, a justification you can make for having the dog speak in one language and the humans in another, and even in English, for an English audience anyway, because the movie is very much from their perspective. And so it puts you, it's interesting in the way that it puts you into the sort of, into the mind of a dog, where you don't quite understand what the human standing in front of you is saying, except you pick out little words here or there. And I thought that was a very interesting choice. Now, why the movie had to be set in Japan as opposed to Portugal or Brazil or anywhere, literally anywhere on the world, I could not give you a reason other than, as you said, he loves Japanese cinema, he loves Japanese iconography, and he wanted to make a movie that had a lot of it in it. But again, I thought a lot of the scenes in Japan itself were very misjudged.
Yeah.
And like having Greta Gerwig play this
foreign exchange student
who is like the only person apparently in Japan who like realizes that, literally trashing the country's dogs is not a nice thing to do and has to like convince everyone else that it's a bad call. That in and of itself was a very bad call.
Yeah, it's not good.
No.
I still, as someone who has always generally liked Wes Anderson, I do feel like, I don't know. It seems unfair to be like someone needs a filmmaker needs to change, and because he, especially when his like voice and tone and style of things that he does are so like clear and have always been so well established.
Sure,
but I do feel like you should grow as a person to at least have some more awareness of things that have always been blind spots for you.
Sure,
to like maybe not. I think the part for the like of this movie that was like most difficult for me was just to be like, you never really like has nothing penetrated whatever kind of like artistic bubble you've created around yourself.
Right. I don't disagree with any of that, but it's like to me even more fundamentally, he doesn't need to grow or whatever, but he's making the same movie over and over again.
Sure.
That gets boring.
Sure.
Like there's an aspect where it's just like, show me something new. Take your technique, take your, your style, your tone, your things that you like to do, and do something a little bit different. As you said, there's a lot about this movie that feels very familiar.
Well, it's caught in this kind of this always like nostalgic juvenile point of view,
right?
Right, like this kind of deliberate naivete. And children are often like the ones who are like, especially in this movie, they're the ones who have the purest,
of course,
ethical point of view.
Always.
And yeah, there's a certain point where you start to get kind of frustrated with that. But
I'm more hot or cold on his movies than you are in general.
Yeah.
But I thought Grand Budapest Hotel was like his masterpiece. I loved that movie. And so to me, this was like a big letdown for me personally.
Yeah. Well, it still, as we said, offers a few pleasures, but it's a very mixed bag.
I could give it a very, very mild recommendation, but no better than that.
Okay.
Let's talk about some of these other movies we have seen. Do you want to very briefly talk about Unsane?
Yes, Steven Soderbergh's iPhone movie and also his Gaslighting movie. You know, it's funny. I saw this over a week ago, and I've still been kind of sorting out how I feel about it. I do think that there's something about the look of the iPhone and the kind of flatness of, like, everything being in focus that really works for this storyline.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if it's, like, the new Red camera. I know he's, like, been going all in on this. He's like, iPhone.
I'm never
going to
make
a future. Yes.
I'm never going to make another movie on a professional
camera. I don't know if it's, like, really a perfect camera. Well, then why not just use a real camera? Claire Foy in this is great, but I also do feel like the script is not great. It's not just in like requiring a lot of like leaps of faith with regard to how certain things happen, but also I think in kind of like leaning into there's one scene that I keep thinking about, which is like very effective in the moment, this confrontation scene, but it also feels like in ways that really bother me now, like think piece bait. Basically,
mm-hmm.
It felt like it was written so that someone on the internet could write a piece about why it's so meaningful. There's something kind of like cynical about that, of the feeling of it, that I think, I don't know. It's a movie that I don't think really earns a lot of the big themes that it kind of wears with regard to gestures towards relevance.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think every movie needs to be relevant, but this one seems to really want to be.
All right. Well, I didn't see that one, but I did see Pacific Rim Uprising.
I did not see that.
So this is the sequel to the Guillermo del Toro Pacific Rim. His name is on the film as like a producer. I don't think he had anything to do with it. If you look on his Twitter page, he has not tweeted about this movie one time in like 2 months. I think he tweeted one thing about the movie, which was like a fan made a Lego version of the trailer, and he tweeted that. And he had not tweeted, the last I looked a few days ago, he hadn't tweeted anything about this movie. And I think that kind of, to me, that's a big glaring warning sign to me. And it definitely feels like he had nothing to do with it, because it just, I mean, I wasn't a huge fan of the first movie, but at least that movie was kind of weird and it felt like a filmmaker was involved in this.
And it felt like a movie that was like about, for whatever it's worth, like a kind of love letter to kaiju movies.
Yeah, this to me, I mean, this feels much more mercenary. It's like we have this property and we can make another one. We have we've already designed all the characters and we already have all the costumes. It's like, let's make another one. So, I mean, the only thing I can say in its favor is John Boyega is the new star. He plays the son of Idris Elba's character who was in the first film. And you could do worse in this life than have a movie with John Boyega as the star. He's
sure.
A really charming, likable
guy. He's very charismatic.
He's very charismatic. And he's pretty good in the movie, given what he has to work with. And, you know, like a world where John Boyega gets to star in huge blockbusters is a world I want to live in. I hope he gets to do more films of this type, I guess, or whatever he wants to do. But, I mean, he's still basically just like a guy in a movie where there's big robots and big monsters. And I mean, there's a couple of mildly clever twists in terms of the story, but I mean, it almost bears no, like, there's almost no way to even convince yourself. You would have to be as drunk as Nick Charles watching this movie to convince yourself that what you're seeing is even close to looking like live action, quote unquote.
Sure.
You know, there are these real people in the movie, like John Boyega, and then they cut away to robots and monsters fighting. And it's like, it really is like very cartoonish.
Yeah.
It is hard to convince yourself you are. And then you go, well, why am I watching a live action movie? Why don't I just watch a cartoon? Like,
right.
If I'm going to watch a cartoon, let a cartoon be a cartoon. Then it could be even more outlandish and more extreme and fun and silly and weird and bizarre. It's like constraining a cartoon to the rules of reality makes it less fun.
Sure.
So to me, it's like It is definitely not worth going out of your way to see. It is definitely a movie that is people are going to watch on an airplane, fall asleep in the middle of, wake up and watch the last 20 minutes and be like, well, that was
a movie.
Fine.
That movie exists.
Yeah. So that's a non-recommendation for me.
All right. Well, the last movie I'm going to talk about briefly is Ready Player One. And I will say this to Ready Player One's credit, that it has a lot of sequences that are extremely, you know, computer imagery filled, right? And they don't look like cartoons. They look, for the most part, like in a way that is really striking compared to after like watching a lot of movies recently in which there's this kind of, the physics aren't quite right. And, it, like, you know, like of even Marvel movies, which clearly spend a lot of money on those sequences. Steven Spielberg's, this young man, Steven Spielberg, his...
Stevie
certainly has, like, knows how to direct these sequences in ways that give them a physicality and an excitement that just, like, you know, it's there is a way to direct them so it doesn't just look like you're watching a cutscene in a video game. And it is, like, the action sequences in Ready Player One look great. I do feel like it doesn't really overcome its source material, which has some immense limitations.
Right.
And especially, I think what's most interesting about this movie is that in ways you feel like Spielberg is kind of warring with the source material, especially towards the end, with regards to trying to figure out like how to make whatever struggle the characters are going through have meaning. You know, because all of this story is about everyone in the world competing in this game that's left behind by this tech mogul so that they can be the one, the winner gets control of the VR internet, basically, that everyone uses to escape from their horrible lives. And I think that it's been a long time now. It's been a while since Spielberg's done like a pure kind of like popcorn movie. And I think what's so interesting about this movie, in ways that have very little to do with, I think, what the movie theoretically aims to give you, is that it's a popcorn movie in which you kind of feel like the director making it is like, this storyline really overvalues entertainment and escapism. like he doesn't buy what the source material is trying to tell you. And so that there's a tension there that is interesting, even though I don't think the movie in the end is like is totally successful, or even like I would say majority is successful, but you know, that's Spielberg.
Yeah.
He's got some stuff going on. So
I'm looking forward to seeing that one. I'm very curious about it. I'm seeing that this week. So we'll see how that goes. But yeah, that's Stevie Spielberg. That kid's got a future. All right, let's get to Behind the Eight Ball here, where we wrap up the show by giving you some recommendations, movie recommendations. Three new films on streaming, two listener recommendations that both of that are sent to us from you guys to our email address, svu@filmspottingsvu.com. And one film chosen blindly by number from our My Lists. Now, also, before we get to that, Allison, we had a contest on our last episode.
We did.
Yes.
We did a giveaway of two Blu-rays of Oscar films, Get Out and I, Tonya. We have two winners, and you each will get one Blu-ray of each. I, Tonya, by the way, Get Out was already available on Blu-ray and digital. I, Tonya is now available for digital rental and purchase, as well as DVD and Blu-ray. So if you're a fan of that movie, it's out there now. But I wanted to say congrats to Neva in Lincoln, Nebraska, and John in Monterey, Massachusetts. You are two winners. I've sent you emails, but congrats, and thank you for sending your recommendations. And thank you, everyone, for sending your recommendations.
We had a lot of entries in that contest. We have a lot of listener recommendations to share over the next couple of episodes, which is
great.
Yes,
we really appreciate it. And there's some really great ones in there. And I will be reading Neva and John's in my Behind the Eight Ball.
Okay, cool. So do you want to go first?
Yeah, why don't I go first?
All right, let's start with three new releases on streaming.
Okay, first up, new to Amazon is Il Mare. Okay, Matt, here's the plot of Il Mare.
I'm ready.
There's a seaside house. Two protagonists are living there. They realize they're living 2 years apart in time.
Whoa.
But they're able to communicate in letters in their mailbox.
This sounds like a lake house kind of situation.
It is the movie that became The Lake House.
What?
I was going to ask. I know. This is a Korean film. The extremely sentimental, but no less enjoyable, kind of time travel romance.
Wow.
That The Lake House was
based know that was a remake.
Yeah. So you can check that out now. It is on Amazon. Il Mare. New to Hulu is Blade of the Immortal. The new Takashi Miike movie. For now, probably he's made
I was gonna say.
Two or three since then. But the 2017 Takashi Miike movie, starring Takuya Kimura, my favorite former boy bander from Japan. There are plenty, but he is my favorite from SMAP. As an immortal samurai, I don't know. There's a lot of fighting and things. It's supposed to be a great action movie. And that is now on Hulu. And finally, also new to Hulu is Jane, Brett Morgan's documentary about primatologists and anthropologists, Jane Goodall. Many people felt like this was robbed when it wasn't nominated for Best Oscar for our documentary. But it is made up of a lot of unseen footage from the National Geographic archives from when she was in her 20s and first going out to kind of observe chimps. And I think it's especially in this movie, there's something really wonderful about it because a lot of it was shot by the man who would become her first husband, Hugo van Leeuwenhoek. I think that especially like you can really sense that this footage is being shot by someone who is like falling in love with the person that he's filming in ways that are quite lovely. So that's Jane, and it is streaming on Hulu.
All right. How about two listener recommendations?
Okay. These are from our winners. Neva and Lincoln writes, I'd recommend the new Netflix doc series, Wild, Wild Country, produced by the Duplass brothers. Growing up, my mother would sometimes mention the Rajneesh up in Oregon in the 80s, but offer few details. The series explores the insane story of the group, which includes land disputes, immigration, racism, group sex, unfortunate matching outfits, the founder of Nike, government spies, election law, and murder attempts. And unlike some Netflix doc series, it is well-paced, well-edited, and only 6 minutes long, or 6 episodes long, 6 minutes. Strongly
wishful
recommended.
Thinking, Allison, wishful thinking.
Yeah, that one is definitely on my list, and maybe will come up later in this episode. And then we also have a recommendation from John in Monterey, Massachusetts, who writes, the show I'm recommending is The Bureau, aka Le Bureau de Légion, from Eric Rochant, which is available on Amazon through Sundance Now, or you can purchase it on iTunes. Le Figaro called this the best TV series ever made in France. I can't remember ever watching a French TV series, so I don't know what the competition is like, but having seen season one, I can certainly see their argument. I'm about to start season two of the three seasons currently available. Apparently a fourth is in the works. The series revolves around the agents of the DGSE, the French spy agency. The central character is Guillaume Desbailly, played by the excellent Mathieu Kassovitz, who returns to Paris after 6 years of undercover deployment in Syria, where he had an affair with Syrian history professor Nadia El-Mansour. He breaks up with her before leaving, but shortly after returning to Paris, he finds that she's in town with a Syrian delegation who are undertaking secret negotiations with Syrian rebels. Although it's strictly against protocol, he arranges to see her and their affair is rekindled. The Syrian security begin to suspect that Nadia is having an affair with a French spy, and Desbailly is put in the position of having to resurrect his cover identity as Paul Lefebvre in an attempt to allay their suspicions. He's now hiding his activities from his superiors at the spy agency, while at the same time hiding his identity from the Syrians. And it develops into a story of a man who is continually trying to fix the mess he made and continually making it worse, eventually involving the CIA and the Russians. And that's just the main plot. There are other fascinating, intertwining stories going on with other agents at the Bureau simultaneously. In some ways, it's reminiscent of MI5, though I found it more character-driven. And it's one long arc rather than being episodic. It felt more realistic to me as well. The acting is uniformly excellent. The direction is crisp and assured. For those who like their espionage deeply plotted and complex while delivering well-rounded, realistic characters, this series is a treat. Thank you for that, John. Definitely sold me. I had registered that series had gone on Sundance Now, but had not actually looked up much about it, and that sounds really interesting.
Mm-hmm. All right. Give me one film, chosen blindly, by number, from your
list. You give me number 9, and number 9, I think, is a movie that you would also probably enjoy. I wonder if it's on your my list.
Let's see.
Is a movie called Inconceivable. Do you know about this movie, Matt?
I don't think I do.
Okay. It is a surrogacy thriller.
Okay.
stars Gina Gershon as Angela.
Keep going.
A woman who develops a friendship with a mysterious woman named Katie.
I like it.
Played by Nikki Whalen, in a part that was originally supposed to go to Lindsay Lohan. Offers her a job as a live-in nanny, but then this soon becomes this dangerous obsession.
Oh, wait.
Uh-huh. Katie gets attached to the family's young daughter.
Yep.
And then Angela and her husband, Brian, played by Nicolas Cage.
Ding, 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 ding.
Realize that something's going on from within. Added bonus, Faye Dunaway plays Nicolas Cage's mother.
Yeah, she's my mom.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I cannot pretend this movie was well-received critically.
It is inconceivable that it could have been well-received critically.
But does that combination of Gina Gershon, Nicolas Cage, and Faye Dunaway in a surrogacy thriller, does that make me want to watch it? Yes, it does.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
I just added it. It's added. Number one. So number one on my list now.
Inconceivable.
Oh, yeah.
You can find it on Netflix.
Yeah. Nice.
All right, Matt. Are you ready?
Yes.
Give me three new releases.
All right. First up on Netflix. Let's get some more. First up on Filmstruck. I don't know what I'm saying. I haven't slept in 4 months. First up on Filmstruck. I wanted to get some more Filmstruck in here. Is Adam's Rib from 1949. It's the sixth of nine films made by Spencer Tracy and Katharine Hepburn, and of the ones I've seen, and I've seen five of them, this is my favorite. They play a married couple, both lawyers, who wind up arguing on opposite sides of a court case that involves the equality of the male and female sexes. Hepburn and Tracy are one of my all-time favorite screen couples. Maybe not Nick and Nora Charles good, but they're pretty darn good together. Mm-hmm. And they're really terrific in this movie. Filmstruck currently has six of the Tracy and Hepburn films. And again, this one is really, really great. It is Adam's Rib on Filmstruck. Next up on Hulu, I have Life Itself, the superb documentary from Hoop Dreams director Steve James about the life of film critic Roger Ebert. Even if you know Ebert's life story, even if you have read the memoir that the film is drawn from, this is still a powerful movie thanks to the archival footage of Ebert and his late partner Gene Siskel and of Ebert himself in his last days as he was fighting cancer. I actually have not watched this movie since it debuted. I haven't been able to bring myself to watch it again, but I feel like I should. Could use a little Ebert inspiration these days, a lot, actually. I think it's 5 years since he passed away coming up next month, which is kind of mind-boggling. So that is Life Itself, available on Hulu. Finally, also on Hulu is Professor Marston and the Wonder Women. Last year's biopic, unfortunately, very little seen, kind of like shockingly low box office numbers for this movie, if you look them up, about the life of the man who created Wonder Woman, played by Luke Evans, Professor Marston, and his unusual long-term polyamorous relationship with two women, his wife, played by Rebecca Hall, and another woman who was a former student of theirs, played by Bella Heathcote. And some of the reviews of this movie, you know, were not as positive. They felt like a movie that was about polyamorous relationships and menage a trois and people who enjoy bondage and role playing and all this sort of stuff, that it needed to be a little, I don't know, kinkier or something, that it was too vanilla. But I felt like that was kind of part of the point of the movie, is that these people were vilified in their day. They were treated like outsiders and such, and that much of the second half of the movie is barely even about the creation of Wonder Woman or the creation of the lie detector, which Professor Marston also helped create. But it's about the prejudice they faced as a I can't say a couple, but as a trio. And so making the film into this kind of mainstream-esque, glossy, Hollywood-style romance, a relationship film or biopic, I felt was sort of a deliberate choice to kind of show that this trio, these people were, you know, that they were just like anyone else, and they're being treated in this movie just like anyone else would be treated, which I actually thought was kind of a nice message. So that is Professor Marston and the Wonder Women, which you can watch now on Hulu.
Okay, give me two listener recommendations.
All right, our first here comes from Patrick in Durham, North Carolina. Patrick writes, I want to recommend the series Bridget and Eamon, which has recently crossed my path through Hulu and Amazon Prime. It's a fast, absurd domestic comedy about a couple in 1980s Ireland. The show sees them becoming condom smugglers, running for local office, faking miracles, and even going
out in the sun. It's full of thick Irish accents. So Americans like me may have to watch it a couple of times to absorb it all, but you'll want to watch it many times for lines like, can a man not use the withdrawal method in his own home? My parents listen to this podcast. This is very uncomfortable for me.
Sorry.
Thanks a lot.
Parents.
Thanks a lot, Patrick, in Durham, North Carolina. Thank you. That is Bridget and Eamon, which I guess is on Hulu and Amazon Prime. Next up, a recommendation from Matt in Madison, Wisconsin. Matt writes, what a great name that is, by the way. I wanted to give a strong recommendation for folks to check out Belladonna of Sadness, which was streaming on Amazon Prime at the time Matt wrote this, but is now streaming on Fandor and Shudder. It is a classic of Japanese animation from 1973, and it was recently given a spectacular restoration. The plot description reads as follows. An innocent young woman is violently raped by the local lord on her wedding night. To take revenge, she makes a pact with the devil, who transforms her into a black-robed vision of madness and desire. The movie's visuals are a combination of slow pans over gorgeous watercolor paintings and lushly animated sequences that sometimes trip into acid-soaked delirium with an appropriately psychedelic score to match. Thematically, the film touches on some points regarding female sexuality and the perception of power therein that should resonate with contemporary viewers. I had the good fortune to catch this on the big screen, and it melted my brain. While the style and subject matter might be a little intense or strange for some, there were walkouts at the screening I attended. I would hope that most SVU listeners would find this to be an enjoyably wild ride. I'm sure my parents would love it. Okay, so that is Belladonna of Sadness, streaming now on Fandor and Shudder. Thank you for that recommendation, Matt, in Madison, Wisconsin.
Okay, give me one from your My List.
You gave me number 11. And, well, now it's something else because I've already added Inconceivable. But at the time that I looked, number 11 was Ash versus the Evil Dead. This is the, I think, still ongoing series from, I believe, Stars originally.
Mm-hmm.
It is the continuation of the Evil Dead saga, starring Bruce Campbell back in his role as Ash from the original three films. And it's produced by Sam Raimi, who made the original films. I think he directed the first maybe one, maybe two episodes. I watched the first couple of episodes when they premiered. I thought it was great fun. I thought it was very faithful to the spirit of the movies. I don't have Stars. And so it took me, I hadn't been able to catch up with it. And it was added a couple of months ago to Netflix, I think. And I popped it on there then. I actually have watched an episode or two since then. It's a great show. I really like it. If I didn't have children and jobs and responsibilities,
sure,
I would definitely have watched the whole thing by now. But
alas,
I have all that parenting and drinking and solving mysteries to do. So I will get to the rest of it eventually. But in the meantime, yeah, it is Ash versus Evil Dead. That is on Netflix. We have a very eclectic batch of films and TV shows for our next listener's choice poll. I have absolutely no idea what's going to win this.
Yeah, I have no idea either. I have a feeling, actually. We'll see. I'm not gonna say.
Don't spoil
that
it.
Way I
clearly,
I can claim to be right if I don't tell you.
Well, also, it obviously doesn't matter what we think, because last time we actually both had a favorite. We very strongly said this is what, not just one person. We both agreed.
Yeah.
And our listeners resoundingly said, we don't care.
I really appreciate that. They're like, this is our choice.
They gave us the Tommy Lee Jones and the Fugitive. I don't care.
Yeah.
So, yeah. And honestly, with this trio, I'm interested in all three.
I am too.
So our first option, available on Hulu, is a film entitled Wolf Warrior 2. It's directed by Wu Jing, who's also the star of the film. And it's mostly a Chinese cast with, do you know the American star in it?
No.
Frank Grillo.
Oh, really?
Yes, Frank Grillo is in the film. I'll read you the plot description. The film tells a story of a loose cannon Chinese soldier named Lang Fang who takes on special missions around the world. In this sequel, he finds himself in an African country protecting medical aid workers from local rebels and vicious arms dealers. I'm going to bet some money that Frank Grillo plays a vicious arms dealer. That's
probably
just a guess. And the reason this is of particular interest is this movie, Wolf Warrior 2, is the highest grossing Chinese film ever. This is a Chinese production and a massive, massive success. The first film was a big hit, and the second film was even bigger. And Chinese films, some of these bigger productions, they're making more and more of these big blockbuster style productions that are doing very well in China and elsewhere internationally.
Yeah.
And so
it's also supposed to be super nationalist. And it was also the Chinese submission for the Academy Awards, which feels a bit like an FU to the Academy Awards to be like, you know what, we're going to submit a sequel that is a massive blockbuster.
Right.
Yeah.
But so it seems like this is kind of attention must be paid, but also a real curiosity factor to see this movie that was such a huge hit and to look at it, see how it looks, see what we think about it. I think that would be very interesting. And we could do like recent Chinese blockbusters,
because
a lot of them are available online.
And a lot of them, the theatrical releases they get in the U.S. are mostly aimed at kind of Chinese diaspora audiences,
right,
and not marketed. So you wouldn't even know that they are around.
But they are
giant movies.
Huge.
Yes.
And a lot of them are now available on streaming services. The other thing is, like Frank Grillo, a lot of them star like one or two American stars. So that'd be kind of fun, too, to see like who pops up in this movie or that movie as well. So that's option number one, Wolf Warrior 2, available on Hulu.
Option number two is a docuseries that we've mentioned earlier in the episode. It's Wild Wild Country on Netflix. Netflix original documentary series based on a controversial Indian guru who tries to set up a community in Oregon, starts clashing with the locals, and then, as you know, a lot of different themes come up in this. It's directed by the Way brothers and produced by the Duplass brothers, so I don't know what to make of that other than that brother teams seem to have like a really disproportionate amount of success in film and television.
Did we ever do a brother filmmaker pairing?
We could. We should absolutely do that.
Okay.
We could do a brother themed brother filmmaker episode.
Okay.
Yeah. But this is also a series that was one that, it was released on Netflix on March 16th. And I've kind of just seen it building an audience.
Starting to percolate.
A lot of people on Twitter have tweeted about it.
Yes.
That it's a well-made film that just covers a lot of really interesting subject matter.
Yes.
So I would be curious to see that
and
have a good excuse to watch it
before
Netflix releases, like probably since
100 more
releases
things.
100 new series and films.
They're the Takashi Miike of streaming services.
Exactly.
They're very prolific.
Very prolific.
Yes.
So that's your second option, Wild Wild Country. It is streaming on Netflix.
Okay. Option number three, also on Netflix, is the smash hit art house film Tulip Fever, directed by Justin Chadwick, starring Alicia Vikander, Dane DeHaan, and Zach Galifianakis. What a cast! During the Dutch Tulip Mania, which is a thing, a historical thing.
Sure.
Tulip Mania, Tulip Fever. It was a real thing. Look it up. Love blooms. I didn't write it. This is what Netflix says. Love blooms between a wealthy merchant's wife and a painter, but their future together hinges on a risky bet. And I guess this film will probably go down in history, or perhaps infamy, as basically like the last Weinstein Company movie.
It is.
It is.
I mean, you know, even if the Weinstein Company has like gone bankrupt, I believe.
Right. Yeah.
But also, like, if any aspect of it survives to kind of, it's going to be rebranded and renamed anyway.
Right.
So that's it. The Weinstein Company.
This was the farewell. I mean, they had other movies like Paddington 2, which wound up coming out from a different theater and studio, excuse me. And I guess they had The Current War, which still hasn't come out. Has anyone bought that yet?
I don't know. But it has some, at least like those titles kind of flopping around in, you know, who knows what will happen to them.
But regardless, this was like the last movie actually released by the actual Weinstein Company.
Yes.
And so I think that gives it a real currency to discuss. We could do a Weinstein Company show.
Sure. Maybe it might be interesting also to just even look, you know, Harvey Weinstein, when all of the kind of like horrible facts of his kind of treatment of actresses and women he worked with, and then also people in general, kind of came to light after all of these reporting started happening. I think there was a lot of kind of talk about what he did in independent film, but I think that it might be good to also talk about, he was like famous for fighting with directors and cutting things.
Absolutely.
And like shelving things.
Including this movie.
And so I think it might be interesting to also go look at some of the films that he didn't treat well, shelved or cut against the will of the filmmakers.
Yes. It'd be hard to recommend movies in that context because so many of them he meddled with in
a
negative way.
But I think that like some of them are also available,
in the untouched versions.
Yeah, like I think like he, you know, made Shaolin Soccer be dubbed, if I'm remembering that correctly.
Yes.
And you don't have to see that. But I think that, like,
it's an interesting topic.
Yeah, certainly. For someone who, definitely was a huge force in independent film, he was not viewed always as
both the champion and the destroyer of independent films.
So that is your third option.
Yes, Tulip Fever on Netflix.
Okay, so it's up to you now. Tell us which of these streaming options we should review on the next episode. You can do that by voting in the poll that's at the bottom of the page over at filmspottingsvu.com. We'll also post links to that poll on our social media feeds. We're on Facebook and Twitter at filmspottingsvu. You've got until Monday, April 2nd at noon to vote. That's when we'll announce the winner. It gives you about a week if you want to watch it in advance before our next episode comes out on Tuesday, April 10th.
In addition to being able to vote at filmspottingsvu.com, that's also where you can find our episode archive, complete with links to where you can stream or rent all the titles we mention on the show. The Film Spotting SVU remix theme song is by Vince Vandal. Find more of Vince's work at vincevandal.bandcamp.com. We'll be back in 2 weeks with more recommendations and the movie or TV review you pick. Until then, you can always find us both on Twitter at Allison Wilmore and at Matt Singer. And you should definitely follow the show at FilmSpottingSVU, where we drop links throughout the day to things that are new to streaming that you might want to know about. For FilmSpottingSVU, I'm Matt Singer.
And I'm Allison Wilmore. Thanks for listening.